centuries and centuries. The persona and the words and the wisdom of this individual are timeless. So here, when we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, we find that there are so many beautiful things which we learn from His Eminence, the Commander of the Believers. Now, one such thing, which of course sometimes as a Muslim and really as a human being, we tend to think about, and that is, what are the foundations of sin? And what can we do in order to weaken the foundation of sin, in order to be able to prevent the onset of committing a sin? Right? So everything has a beginning and an end as far as actions are concerned. So we're trying to find what is the precursor, what is the prerequisite of this sin which we can prevent. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, in his universal persona, he says that one of the things that ruins the foundations of sin is a timely confession. Allahu Akbar. So when we confess in a timely manner, now what do we mean by confess? Confess meaning we admit to ourselves, we admit to Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, and we ask for forgiveness for that sin which we have done. So that means confession. Now what do we mean by timely? Timely means, in this context, as soon as possible. Do not delay this confession. So when we're talking about now timely confession, timely meaning as soon as possible, confession meaning that we should admit to ourselves and admit to Allah and then ask for forgiveness. Now when we do this, when we as soon as possible ask for forgiveness and admit to Allah and are ashamed in the presence of Allah for committing this sin, this ruins the very foundations of sinning. Now this doesn't necessarily mean that when we do this the first time, it will destroy the very foundations of sin and we will never sin again, or we will never commit that specific sin again. Insha'Allah, may Allah bless us, and it is possible, why not? But we should keep in mind that there is a higher likelihood that it will take repetition, it will take continuous istighfar, asking for forgiveness, and continuous timely confession for us to truly be able to ruin the very foundation of a specific sin. Of course, like we said, it takes time, it takes repetition, it takes stability, and it takes determination, it takes motivation. When all of these things come together, and as soon as possible we admit to ourselves that we committed a sin, and we admit to Allah the Almighty, the Most Quick to Forgive, that we sinned, and we feel regret and remorse and shame, and finally we ask for forgiveness, this will slowly but surely destroy the very foundations of sin. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. كل صبح وكل شراب ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Oh, ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام، چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی،
human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
This is a khutbah that Ali gave after he was accepted as the Khalifa of the Muslims. And so he ends this part by saying, وَلَهُمْ خَصَائِصُ حَقِّ الْوِلَايَةِ وَفِيهِمِ الْوَصِيَّةِ وَالْوِرَاسَةِ Ali Muhammad possessed the special qualities for authority, the wilayat or the ummah. And they have, in their favor exist, the will and the succession of the Prophet on no one else's back. And they're referring to his own Khilafat at that time. He says, Al-an is raja al-haqq ila ahlihi. Now the right, the haqq, the truth has returned to its rightful owner. Where it was before, it wasn't in the hands of the rightful owner. And this is where we see, you know, the importance of Amir al-Mu'mineen when he talks about Ahlul Bayt. You know, these are not the issues of those who are ghali, exaggerating the position of Ali Muhammad. Amir al-Mu'mineen, one of the beauties of him which transcends time and space is his quality of ilm and his insistence on justice. When you look at his adl and justice, a Christian writer from Lebanon talks about the life of Ali, and the title of the book says quite a lot. Ali, the voice of human justice. For him, Ali becomes the voice of human justice. And he was so much particular about this issue. Actually, there is a saying among historians where they say, قُتِلَ فِي الْمَحْرَابِ لِشِدَّةِ عَدْلِهِ. Ali was killed in the mihrab, and the purpose, the motivation behind his murder was his insistence, his shiddat on the matters of justice. Even when it came to a situation where a lady had gone to Muawiyah when he became the ruler, representing a tribe of Hamdan from the Yemenis, with a complaint. And Muawiyah was told that she is one of those who were very powerful in motivating the members of her family to support Ali and to fight for Ali against Muawiyah in Siffin. She was a good poetess in her own right. And because of that, you know, Muawiyah started saying, you have done this and that, and this is, you said this and that against us. And some very, you know, bitter statements were exchanged between her, a very courageous lady, going to the, you know, Sultan of the time. And then Muawiyah says, you know, what can you do if I don't listen to your request about your tribe? At that moment, she started reciting two couplets from herself, where she says that may Allah shower his blessings on the soul, that when he was buried, justice was buried with him. And so I don't see a justice now. And Muawiyah says, whom are you remembering? She says, I am remembering Ali. When Ali was killed and he was buried, justice was buried with Ali. This was the sense that even at his, you know, during his own time, the contemporaries, you know, they appreciated this quality of Amir al-Mu'mineen when it came to adl and justice in his family life, with his companions, even with the enemies.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemen health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthen our economic, trade and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis. The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories, detaining dozens of Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Society revealed that the arrests were made mainly in Ain al-Sultan camp in Ariha, also known as Jericho, and Al-Jalazon refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as in a number of villages west of the city. The society accused Israel of trying to find different excuses to raid Palestinian areas. This time, the Israeli army announced that its forces operating in the West Bank were exposed to fire more than once by Palestinian resistance fighters.
The reasons behind arresting Palestinians this time are many and different. And the goal is to drain the energy of the Palestinian people, in which they won't resist Israel, the occupation. The Israeli tries through detention to convince the people that there is no way to achieve victory.
Israeli forces continue to storm Palestinian villages and cities on a daily basis under the excuse of arresting Palestinian activists. In the village of Qatani, northwest occupied Al-Quds, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded before they were detained.
These campaigns are part of Israeli oppression that aims at breaking the Palestinian resistance to occupation, but they will not succeed. And in my opinion, all these arrests reflect the crisis of the Israeli system that does not understand that Palestinians will never give up.
Palestinians warn that Israel's escalated crackdown against the activists and the use of excessive force is meant to fight the Palestinian resistance. They see the operations as a failed attempt to intimidate the youth into giving up resistance. Israel holds thousands of Palestinians, including women and minors, in jail. Israel intensifies its arrest campaigns against Palestinians under the pretext of a policy known as mowing the lawn, which is aimed at re-arresting Palestinian activists to prevent any forms of resistance. Experts say these detentions remain as part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against the Palestinians. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
In honor of tens of athletes and sporting clubs, the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine held the International Forum to honor anti-normalization athletes under the slogan Al-Quds Golden Medal in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
We are honoring these champions from Iran and different Arab countries because they refuse to play against an Israeli player because they don't recognize the so-called Israel. They paid a heavy price for that. We look at them as heroes.
Fathi Nourin, an Algerian and world champion who pulled out of four different competitions after finding out he would compete with an Israeli competitor, was punished by the International Judo Federation, which withdrew his Olympics accreditation. But he noted that nothing is more significant than Palestine.
For us as athletes in Algeria, nothing is more valuable than the Palestinian cause, which is the cause of all Arabs and Muslims. And we are in solidarity with them and back them in any way we can. We have the chance to send a message to the world and raise awareness through sports about the Israeli terrorism, since the Israelis have been trying to win recognition through sports competitions, and we can through sports show the truth.
The athletes who were honored through their matches in international and regional tournaments to protest the presence of Israeli players or teams. Two chess players also had their share of a gold medal. So did 14-year-old Mauritanian Mohammed Abdulrahman.
There was like three people that qualified from Africa and I qualified. And during that tournament, it was the last round, I played against this Israeli guy. And I just didn't play since it's a common gesture and I stand with Palestine.
The global campaign to return to Palestine stressed that they wanted to launch this initiative to show that these athletes who paid a price, whether being dismissed from international tournaments or deprived of important medals and valuable prizes, have won people's respect for their stance in defense of Palestine and the culture of resistance. These athletes said they decided to rescind an international competition and prize if it meant recognizing Israeli occupation and apartheid state. Yet little did they know that by so doing, they became champions for millions of hearts across the Arab and Muslim worlds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year, but NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We're asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Leading business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs were invited to a special place, Beit Rahbari. That's the official residence of Iran's leader. The meeting was aimed at allowing industrialists to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in the production process with leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening and taking notes.
Your Highness, production is always associated with problems. If we want to produce, we need to brace for any possible problems. I dare say even the world's biggest entrepreneur, Mr. Bill Gates, could not manage a coffee shop under these difficult circumstances. But Iranian producers managed to run their businesses with all the foreign-imposed hardships.
Let's not sacrifice domestic production for imports. I proudly say that our biotech products have the capacity to be exported to other countries if the government lends its support.
At a time when the coronavirus pandemic led many countries to face shortage in medical supplies, Iran faced yet another problem, US sanctions. But thanks to the efforts of our medical producers, we did not face any shortage in medical items during the pandemic.
We are fighting an economic war. We Iranian producers are the economic soldiers. So it's heartwarming when our leader lends his support for us. But it entails practical steps by authorities to make a change.
We got along with sanctions. We learned how to run our businesses despite the sanctions. The only thing we need to do is to modify our domestic regulations in favor of local producers.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed the efforts of Iranian economic operators in keeping domestic production and the economy afloat amid the toughest sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran. He said, thanks to those efforts, the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has hit the wall, and that's what American officials have also admitted. Addressing the government officials present in the meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei put major emphasis on the need to avoid tying the economy to the outcome of the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution believes the ultimate solution to the country's economic problems is to rely on the young minds. As he said, they have proved competent in all areas, from the production of COVID vaccines to precision-guided missiles. It's the second time in almost 2 years that Iran's leader has met with Iranian producers. Ayatollah Khamenei has on different occasions highlighted the need to boost domestic production as the key to resistance economy. To this end, he has taken symbolic and practical measures, including naming the current Persian year the year of production, support, and the elimination of obstacles, calling on authorities to materialize this slogan.
Boosting domestic production has been one of the main concerns and priorities of Iran's leader. Today, he once again urged the Iranian government to not wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions to fix the economy, and instead capitalize on local producers, as he believes this is the only way toward a resilient economy that can withstand foreign pressures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Al-Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Al-Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Naqab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Naqab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Naqab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Al-Naqab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Naqab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis.
Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences.
Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There is an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for a negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week, and once again, US-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Daniel Larrison, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "The Saudi Coalition War on Yemen Claims More Victims." Stay tuned for more. The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week, and once again, US-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. The death toll from a coalition airstrike on a detention facility filled with migrants in northern Yemen has risen to at least 87 people, and hundreds more were injured in the attack. Fragments of the weapon found in the wreckage were identified as coming from ammunition manufactured by Raytheon. A separate airstrike in Hodeidah knocked out Yemen's internet connectivity, which has cut Yemenis off from remittance payments and compromised the ability of humanitarian aid agencies to provide relief. At the same time, the coalition blockade has tightened and worsened the country's fuel crisis. As it has done since the war began almost 7 years ago, the Saudi coalition punishes the population of Yemen, and it still enjoys total impunity for its many crimes. The US did not condemn the atrocity at the detention facility, nor did it criticize the Saudi coalition perpetrators for the massacre. All that the Biden administration could muster in response was to say that they are deeply concerned and that the escalation in fighting was of great concern. US Secretary Blinken made a point of calling the earlier attack on Abu Dhabi deliberate without reaching the same conclusion about the much deadlier coalition airstrikes. This is unfortunately consistent with the Biden administration's overall handling of relations with the Saudi and Emirati regimes, which never face any consequences in Washington for crimes they have committed in Yemen or elsewhere. It is a measure of the absurdity and lopsided nature of the United States debate over Yemen
that the only party to the conflict that is being considered for any U.S. punitive measures are the Ansarullah movement. The United Arab Emirates is demanding that the U.S. redesignate the popular Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization, and Biden has said he will consider doing so. It was the Biden administration that previously lifted the designation last year because they understood that the sanctions that came with a designation would be a death sentence for millions of Yemenis. But now there is pressure on Biden to endorse a policy of collective punishment against a population that is already experiencing mass starvation and famine. Yemen has already been suffering from the effects of coalition blockade, an economic war since 2015, and sanctions would be a new and heavy burden. The United States regime has been squarely on the side of the aggressors in this conflict, and it continues to shield them from the retaliation that their intervention has caused. As long as the United States supports and protects the Saudi and Emirati regimes, the harder it will be to end the war and the devastating humanitarian crisis that have already claimed more than 377,000 lives.
Imam Rida Masjid, leading imam for Imam Rida Center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people, they would go to this Islamic center.
And Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not unfortunately successful and he was martyred.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the new series of the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones, who dedicated their life into spreading Islam and the Shiite Islam all around the world. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the outstanding Shiite clerics and preachers of Islam, Abdullah Dahdo. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life and the education of Abdullah Dahdo.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo, born in 1966 in Morocco, and then moving to Belgium when he was a child and growing up in Belgium, going to the schools over there and learning French language. Then as a religious man, he started to get to know about Shia school of thought, and he was really interested to Ahlul Bayt school of thought, and he converted to Shiism. In order to complete his knowledge and studying on Shiism, he moved to Iran, and he went to some schools, and he went back to Belgium, completed his studies in the university in Belgium. Again, he came back to Iran in order to complete his Islamic studies in Jamaat al-Mustafa al-Alamiyya.
Oh, really? Was he a student of Jama?
Yes.
In Iran, okay,
and
cool.
Then you might say, when he went back again to Belgium, mainly Brussels, he started his tablighi life,
yes,
as the leader of the Ahlul Bayt community, which is mainly for the Morocco people, because in Belgium and Brussels we have different communities. We have Iranian communities, Iraqi communities. Each and every of these communities, they've got their Islamic center. But Imam Ridha Masjid, which was being lead, or the leading imam for Imam Ridha center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people,
yes,
they would go to this Islamic center, and other people from other communities.
So,
but mainly, okay, this community was for the Moroccan people. Yeah.
So there were Islamic centers before Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo goes to Brussels. Okay, over there. But special centers for the Moroccans, the people from the same country he was born in, Brussels, Belgium, and he was leading the Shiite center over there, isn't it?
Yeah, this is actually what I said. Imam Ridha Islamic Center, or you may say Islamic, actually Imam Ridha Masjid. Is one of the masjid for the Shia community.
Yes.
And mainly this community was the Moroccan people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdawi. Sheikh Zainal, let's get to some of his tablighi or preaching efforts over there. What are they, Sheikh Abdullah Dahdos?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdawi, mentioned, he started his tablighi actions and preaching activities after returning back from the second trip that he had in Iran and completed his Islamic studies in Jamaat al-Mustafa. Then he came back to Belgium. He started his tablighi activities and preaching activities in Brussels in Masjid al-Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And he was not only giving lectures there. Besides giving lectures and inviting people, he wrote a book that is Al-Hurriya Fil Islam Wal Gharb, that means the freedom in Islam and the West. And also he was involved in publishing a magazine that was in French language. The name was Shu'ab Al-Hikmah and was welcomed by European people, Muslims, in some countries. That the subject of this magazine was some, you know, legislative, or we may say theological issues.
Yes.
So he was a member of the World Assembly of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam, and was invited to give lectures in different countries. He had many visits and trips to Iran to participate in different conferences and also in different countries. Another important point that we should mention about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo is that he welcomed African Muslims and African Shia people that were living in Belgium. You know, sometimes in some centers and masjids we see in different countries that unfortunately, this is not common, but sometimes we see this, that some ethnic issues are involved and are, you know, entered into the mosques and masjids. Some people, they do not allow other nationalities to enter their mosques. This is not something, you know, acceptable by Islam.
Yes.
Of course it's few, but we should be aware that we should stand against it and try to erase it completely.
Isn't it sometimes because of the standards of the living of that Western country? Or the laws, for example?
No.
No?
It's rooted in the cultures of people.
Okay.
You know, we as Iranians, maybe we are more comfortable to
have connection with the Iranians.
Yes.
For example, Iranians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Africans have their own communities over
exactly
there.
Exactly, this is the case.
This must not be the case.
Yeah.
The communities must welcome each ethnic group too.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that's the point that Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo focused on and tried to invite African people who were living in Belgium and Brussels especially to that mosque, and welcomed there. No difference they were from Morocco or from different countries, but you know, maybe these people were not welcomed in different centers, and this was not a good point.
And this is not only in Europe, in different countries I have seen this, that some nationalities are more welcoming to their own, you know,
yes,
friends from their own countries,
yes,
not other nationalities.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziania. So, Sheikh Mahtavi, give us a picture of the Muslim communities and the Islamic communities in Belgium. Because Abdullah Dahto was working over there, he was active over there in preaching Shia Islam. What communities do we have over there? How many? And give us some details about Islamic communities.
Okay. Actually, the population of Belgium is 11 million people. From this 11 million people, above 400,000 people are Muslims, and among this 400,000 people, something around 30,000 are Shia. And I've heard from some of the citizens who are living in Brussels, specifically Brussels, they are saying that Brussels is the same as the Qom. They are saying that Brussels is the Qom to Europe.
Really?
Well, because the actually appearance of the city is really looking like a Muslim county or Muslim city, because most of the women are wearing hijab and you see masajid here and there.
Okay.
Among the Shia community, with this population of 30,000 people, mm-hmm, we have four masjid. This is besides Islamic Center, because as far as I know, at least Iranian community, they themselves, they right now they have three leading centers. Yes. That these three leading centers are not included under those masajid.
Okay.
So in such small city, for one community, as mean Shia community, to have four masjid, that is something big, specifically in the Europe. So before we get into the actually last scene of the life of Sheikh, yes, Abdullah, I think this is good to talk about the Muslim environment in that city.
Mm-hmm.
The time Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo got martyred actually is the peak time of ISIS.
Okay.
And we see how the activities of ISIS is going to affect other Muslim environment here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if you are living in the heart of the Europe. Why? Because we have a big community of Muslims. So this big community, among their leaders, they are going to get effect. I mean, those negative effect of the extremism,
yes,
which is being practiced,
that's
by
right,
some sort of Muslims.
Okay.
And the result of this is the clashes and conflicts among Muslim denominations,
oh,
for which we can see something like this happen.
That's
but
right.
I think our brother will speak about that,
okay,
much better.
About the details of his shahada.
Yeah.
So he was martyred over there. And that's all right. You know, this ISIS look at the life of the Muslims all here and there, I think culminated and led into a kind of a separation, sedition, disagreement among the Muslims. This is how the Wahhabis and, you know, out of law, is better to say, or extremist Muslims look at the religion of Islam. And this is very much different from the peaceful talks and the efforts that people like Abdullah Dahto had in Brussels. Okay, so Sheikh Ziania, he was martyred. How? Yes, he was the imam of the mosque at Ridha, and he went into the mosque for praying Salatul Maghrib. He was preparing the mosque for Jama'ah prayer, and suddenly the glass of the window was broken and somebody, okay, threw a fire into the mosque, and the mosque was burned. And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire,
mm-hmm,
but he was not unfortunately successful, and he was martyred. Of course, there are some, you know, narrations that they may say that one of these Takfiri people entered the mosque and hit him by a hammer that killed him at the scene, but some others say no, he was martyred by
the
flames.
The killer, the assassinator, was a Takfiri one?
Yes, they were three people, Takfiri,
okay,
people,
okay,
that they were giving some slogans regarding Takfiris,
okay,
when they were burning the mosque.
That's all right.
And there's a documentary also made by an Iranian director regarding the life of Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu under the title of Qurnus, that
Phoenix.
In English, yeah, we call it Phoenix.
Yes.
And the title is, you know, good for him because Qurnus and yeah. Phoenix is bird.
According to Iranian mythology, or
yeah,
the Persian
and also
war
in other, yeah, in other
fire, yes.
And Phoenix is burned in
okay.
fire.
Yes.
And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu also was martyred
this
by
way.
Fire. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul and place him beside Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa sallam and Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Okay. His body was taken out to his homeland in Morocco.
Yes, yes.
yes. And he was buried over there.
In Tangier.
In Tangier, that's right. But the case is that the court of Belgium, can say, imprisoned the assassinator only for 27 years, you know, because of the killing of somebody. But according to their own laws, you know, for 27 years for imprisonment. That's all right. This was the life of Abdullah Dahdo.
And he was martyred in 2012.
12, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 10 years ago. You know... That's right, during Namaz and the prayer time and Salah time, he was martyred and passed away. May Allah bless his soul, and may Allah protect all the Muballaghs, you know, and Muballaghas who are trying their best in order to preach Shia Islam all across the world through, this is my emphasis, through peaceful coexistence and peace talks and peaceful manners. And this is how the religion of Islam invites the other people into itself, embracing Islam through first recognition of the sources, recognition of the ulama, through tahqiq and through peaceful talk. There is no force, there is no killing, there is no assassination. And all these extremist groups and extremist, you know, actions that we could see by some groups are under the flag of Islam, but they are not Muslims. Believe me, these people are not Muslims. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziania.
You're most welcome,
and Sheikh Mahtabi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.